But tonight, I'm very pleased to have two of the founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea, Rob Schmidt and Stuart Goodnick, here. Rob Schmidt has a PhD in anthropology, and Stuart Goodnick, and he have been leaders of the Taiyu Meditation Center for 20 years or something like that. You've been practitioners for over 30 years.
Right? 35 years, okay.
So it's just delightful that they have taken the time out of their busy schedules to give a talk here tonight. And the talk tonight will be on the subject of the renewal of presence. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yay!
Before we start, I want to ask, is anyone in the audience musically inclined?
Yeah.
And do any of you ever have blockages, creative blockages in your music?
Creative what?
Creative blockage. So I just want to point out that we have Ganesha, the remover of obstacles, who has a guitar. So this particular Ganesha is especially tuned for musicians, and for tonight,
those obstacles.
Tonight only, 15% off for anyone who would like to take Ganesha home and have some help with that those musical blockages.
Very good. So
now back to our regularly scheduled program.
Well, that's certainly congruent with our regularly scheduled program, because we want to be paying attention tonight to presence and renewing it, whatever the heck that means. So let's talk about what that means. First, what is presence? What do you guys think? I mean, I wrote up a thing, you know, so I can talk on it forever.
I find it under the Christmas tree around this time of year, right?
The gentleman over there in the green sweater was making a joke exactly to that effect earlier today with me.
Being in the moment,
that seems like a good. But what does it mean to be in the moment? I mean, how do you not be in the moment?
Being unaware.
What's the contrast?
Being unaware of what is around you.
Okay. What is around you? All right. So if you're aware of what's inside you, but not outside you, is that presence or not?
I would think that it depends on whether you are in a meditative state.
Okay.
If you're aware of what's inside you, then you're not paying attention to things around you.
Okay.
So
if you're in a meditative state, but maybe we should back up and decide what a meditative state is. So any help here on what a meditative state would be?
Well, in answer to your first question, it's not being in the future and past. We asked to contrast it.
Okay.
It's T equals zero. And
T equals zero, that's pithy.
Yeah, that's the physics definition of it.
And, got my attention.
And your question was?
The question was, what's a meditative state?
That would be
because that arose out of...
Where you diminish brainwaves for... thought processes other than just the frequencies that are used for maintenance of the body to continue.
Okay, so diminish brain waves. By that, can I understand you to mean that, and correct me if I'm wrong,
mm-hmm.
Can I understand you to mean that that would mean that the little voices in our heads would not be present or be present, or is that even relevant to the question?
Well, technically not present, just be the maintenance, those frequencies that are required to do the basal maintenance.
Well, let me ask a question about that. Would you say, can there be a meditative state and the voices in the head operating simultaneously?
Not technically, but it depends on the nuance of who's using the vocabulary.
Okay.
Okay.
Depends on what you're using it for, too. My meditative state is a tool.
Say that again.
My meditative state is used as a tool.
Okay, and what are you trying to accomplish with it?
I send heat to the joints that bother me the most. Mm-hmm. I was told years ago that's what I should do, get regular massages, and meditate every day because I have joint problems, and so send heat to the joint that bothers you the most. So for me, it's a tool, and it works.
So for you, the meditative state is a concentration of attention on a part of the body that has the attribute of a sensation of heat.
Mm-hmm. Well, with the intention of imbuing that,
with the intention to relieve pain.
Right, but with the intention also to bring something to, you're bringing your attention to that part of the body as well. Okay. So we've got some balls in the air here. Any other ideas about what we might mean by presence and the things associated with presence?
Seems to me both questions can be approached. They ask the same question, but in different ways.
Okay.
And for me, it's just a matter of being who you are, when you are, where you are, and how you are.
Okay.
There is no, it's the practice of isness.
Okay. So that sounds like it's congruent with what this gentleman was saying earlier about not being in the past, not having your attention focused on ideas about the past or the future. Would that be a fair statement in part of what you're saying? I'm not saying that would exclude that's the entirety of what you're saying, but
right,
it would be consistent with it.
Right. I think I need to add a. My mind isn't working. I've just driven 8 hours, so I apologize. I think one of
well, maybe that would be a good thing in this discussion.
I think one of the things people who are into meditation need to avoid is practicing no mind. Mm-hmm. And I know that's a common statement, but it's hard to achieve. But yet it's not no mind either. If you practice the first part, you have isness, which is no mind, and there is no past or present. You exist in the moment.
Okay. Got it.
But I guess I was not. You said something that I was confused about. Were you suggesting that people who practice meditation sometimes overemphasize this no mind, or were you saying that no mind is in fact the focus of meditation?
I think that Westerners, including myself, misunderstand practicing no mind. And because we mispractice it, it's a danger to us.
Am I understanding you to say that the mispractice has something to do with like an active suppression of
Correct.
A mental process as opposed to a organic state of openness or something?
Correct.
Okay, and so when you approach, if you have the definition that the no mind is a something that means no thoughts, that Westerners will tend to kind of emphasize or try to suppress or shut down thinking as opposed to something else that might be going on.
Exactly.
Or something else that might be possible. Okay.
All right. Well, that's a pretty rich start. Any other contributions?
I do. When I think of is when, like, it's used as a something, like a description of somebody. So you say that personality has presence. You'll hear that a lot as a people say, like, that particular person out of the group has a presence. Mm. So it seems like when they say that, it seems like that type of person is sort of like what you were saying, like, is self-possessed. Like, they tend to be... have some kind of magnetism so that the group operates around them. They tend to be a central figure. They tend to be catered to rather than catering. You know, they they tend to be of themselves, and so everybody else, it's sort of stability amidst movement, you know, like mm-hmm. the 10 tarot or something. So everybody else kind of operates, the world revolves around them because they have presence.
So the other people in whatever group you're referring to, just go ahead and turn.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
I don't want to answer it. They'll probably just go away.
Well, can you turn it off?
Yeah.
I can turn it down.
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Well, so just from what I was hearing you saying is that if someone, there's like more there, someone, and we say someone's really there.
They've got presence.
They have presence.
Yeah, they walk in a room. It's like you have 20 people walk in a room, and then one person walks in a room, people will say, that person has presence.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that when you mentioned such people tend to be catered to, because a counterexample that came up was someone like Mother Teresa, who is someone whose presence was partly defined by the intensity with which they embodied service to other people, mm-hmm. even though it's true that she was catered to.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be as Carole King defines Mick Jagger?
No. Say it again, I'm sorry.
Wouldn't that be as Carole King defined Mick Jagger?
You'll have to share it with that.
In the song, he walks into the room.
Does she say that?
It's a song from the 60s.
Well, you can. I mean, I think it's an important distinction to make between charisma and presence. That is to say, there might be a difference between someone who has something that we might call charisma and something that we might call presence. And so, without trying to parse that distinction right now, I'll agree that there are qualities of certain people that I have met that I would point to if I were going to describe someone who embodies presence, someone who can actually seem to inhabit their body fully, number one, and as well their mind and emotions fully. Yeah.
Would that be definition one, two, or three of three definitions of the use of the word presence?
I would say that would be a possible definition. But I'm not particularly interested in coming up with a single definition,
right.
because then it's all too easy to get sort of fixated on that, and that narrows what I think we can do here, which is actually, on the contrary, expand our understanding of what it might mean to be present. So for example, if you, as often happens in this store, someone will come in the door, a mother or a father, with a very young baby, holding a very young baby, and I get to look at this very young being, unmediated between he or she and me. And if I strive, and I'll explain, we can talk more about this later, if I strive to let my presence meet her presence or his presence, the baby's presence, so that there's no obstacle between us, then that might be another way to think about how presence exists in our lives. So I'll suggest to you that very young babies would have a hard time not being present in a certain kind of way. That is, they don't have any choice about where they direct their attention very much. Later, we start to get tools arise in our lives which allow us to direct our attention, and those become very important. Language is a big one, certainly, And when language comes around, then we can even direct our attention to not just the voices we hear from the mouths of the people that we are present with physically or through an electronic medium, but also the voices that get somehow encapsulated in our own heads. And there's all these ways that language pulls at our attention and is very seductive at times equally as repulsive. But that strength of repulsion is just, I'll suggest for your consideration, can be just as much a direction of attention as someone that you really want to listen to. You really want to hear what they have to say. You really want to be around that person. So there's all kinds of ways in which we start to learn willy-nilly how to direct attention in our lives. And as we do that, we see people around us enacting ways of directing attention, and we model those. And I'm not just talking about parents or family, but I'm talking about everyone that we come in contact with. So we start to really find ourselves, instead of being in that way of in which a baby is in the world, we find ourselves with all these alternative places to direct attention and alternative ways to direct attention. And it's very simple in many cases, very complex in other cases, but it's about where we put our attention, where it goes, and how much we even think about the process. Certainly before I met my spiritual teacher at the age of 24, I never thought about the process of where I direct my attention. At least I don't recall particularly thinking about it, that process. I didn't think of it as a process. I thought of my mind had its... I imagined that my mind was master of the interior and immediate exterior environment, in negotiation with other beings in my neighborhood. Stuart was just telling me earlier today about an interesting study, though, that casts doubt on the idea of just how much responsibility we can assume that we have about our behavior. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I'll mention that. This is an article that appeared, I think, very recently in Mother Jones, and it's a study that actually a series of studies that were done that show that the best it gives a case for what the best explanation of the rise of the crime rate from the early 60s to a peak in like the 80s, both in cities but also nationally, and then the sudden drop-off that we saw. Now everyone has a theory about what the drop-off is, like Rudy Giuliani, for instance, takes credit for, you know, more police on the streets of New York. We've built lots of prisons, we've prosecuted a drug war. But none of those explanations actually completely follow the data or explain why, when conditions change, that the crime rate continues to drop. And the best correlation, actually, is the amount of lead in the environment, particularly correlated with, I think it's tetraethyl lead, which was the additive in gasoline. And what's interesting is that from 1937 to about 1960 or so, there was a rise in the use of the, lead in gasoline, and then the environmental movement started to taper that back, and there was a drop-off, a much sharper drop-off. And it turns out that if that rise time and fall maps perfectly with a 20-year shift to crime rates. So basically, children exposed to increasing lead levels in the environment showed a greater propensity for committing violent crimes. And the studies have been done, some after this initial study, other researchers did studies that looked at different states, because different states had different timetables in which they brought in, like lead-free gas laws. And so there's a differential in most of the states between crime statistics and lead in the environment, and it turns out that if you look differentially at the states, that you see the same kinds of correlations. That it breaks down basically that the amount of lead in the environment is the correlates with rise and fall in crime, in violent crime. And this is interesting in light of this discussion, because when you really reflect on that and what that means, studies have shown the effects of lead on developmental, the developing brain has certain consequences, and the consequences tend to affect centers in the brain for things like ability to hold attention. So like ADHD and things like that tend to be exacerbated, and these factors, and intelligence is impacted. So these factors all sort of lead to a propensity for statistically for greater likelihood of someone in that condition to be committing a crime. It also happens to be the case that there's a higher correlation with high lead environments and low income environments, and so you can see that same kind of play. And so what this suggests, though, and what I was reflecting on when I was reading this in light of our discussion tonight, is that I was reminded of the fact that our habitual state of mind is to consider that we're the authors of our actions, that we set out, we choose what we do. We have intentions, we certainly experience our lives that way, that we're free agents, we make decisions, we do things. And yet this study was reminding me that, in fact, statistically, if you look at the mass of activities of any person, and if you look at, if I look at my own life, for instance, and look at the factors that lead up to me making decisions about what I'm going to do moment to moment, that a good case can be made that there are other factors that I'm completely unaware of that are actually controlling what that decision might be.
Or at least shaping and influencing.
So maybe you could say that whereas I might still have the illusion of free will, these factors and these environmental factors, these conditions of my body, are actually things that statistically will dispose me to take certain kinds of actions, and that I'm not really as free as I think I am. That there's something that's unexamined, there's something going on that makes me act the way I do. And when I was reflecting on that in this context, it's often we talk about, I felt like doing that. We'll explain what we do by saying, I feel like doing that. Today, I took running gear to work. I'm coming over a cold, so I left myself some wiggle room. But, at the moment of decision, I didn't feel like doing it. And yet, another part of me had this idea that I was going to complete this action. So, was that presence? Or was that simply me surrendering to a body state that was arising at that moment, with which I had no real particular relationship beyond its suddenly just being in my face?
Well, hold on. I want to jump in here because I wouldn't ask the question, is that presence? Or put it in that way, because the way I was framing the discussion a moment ago was to ask if there's something before presence that is a simplistic form of presence. Our teacher used to call the state of most people in at a very young age as a kind of innocence. Innocence, children are innocent, babies are innocent, and then we lose our innocence over time. That's the model he would propose. And eventually spiritual practice could offer a way to regain innocence with knowledge. That was his formulation of it. But what I'm suggesting here tonight is that the innocence of a child is not the same as the presence cultivated by an adult practitioner, someone who has gone through all the steps that we all go through in finding ourselves, imagining ourselves to be the authors of our actions, but eventually coming to realize that, I guess maybe I don't know why I did that, really. I don't know why I got into that relationship. I don't know why I ended up not going to college but getting a job. I'm talking about myself here. You know, I put off going to college. I mean, I'm overeducated now, but I put off going to college for quite a few years and was doing a blue collar job. And why did that happen? Well, it happened for a number of reasons that I don't have time to go into right now. But it wasn't because I had sat down to make a reasoned evaluation of my options in life and had chosen a particular course based on that. That would have been an illusion. That was the illusion that I thought I was doing the best I could under difficult circumstances, and I was, but I was not capable, because I had this way of being in the world, of not examining what I was doing, of not looking at the processes that governed what I was doing, such that I had no capacity to do anything beyond something like what Stuart's describing. Now, there are many processes in our lives, and they interact, and so to you know, we can't ascribe lead poisoning to all social ills to lead poisoning.
Although there is that phrase, "Get the lead out."
That's true. There is that phrase.
Well, do you
exactly.
think there's a certain amount of control then with presence, in a sense, because a child is willing to do or say anything that comes to mind, whereas as we become adults, we become a little more controlling of our emotions.
Yes.
And when we're out of sync, then that's when we do or say something that we wish we hadn't.
Well, that's a very good question, and so one of the things that we might one of the ways to tease this out would be to recognize that, in fact, I think you're exactly right. The way we are trained to be successful adults in the world is to embody rules about behavior. I mean, you know, either, you know, when the cop pulls you over, you don't get out of the car and start running at him for a variety of reasons. You know, waving your arms, saying, "Why did you do that? Why were you, you know, why are you?"
And yet, the application or the experience of these rules that we have, at least to me, has more of the flavor of what this gentleman was talking about with suppression of certain internal processes. That we're aware vaguely of something arising that we squash down in order to maintain a particular state. And so there's some process going on that's clamping down, which has a decidedly different flavor experientially to what we might remember from childhood when there were moments of unalloyed joy, when we would just be out there not trying to do anything in particular, but just being fascinated and completely enthralled by the world around us. The quality of that place or that experience is very different than the control that you were describing.
Unfortunately.
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, the truth is that's why adults get exhausted by being around kids, because kids have this incredible energy to engage with life, and adults have all these obstacles to engaging with life because they're afraid of breaking the rules. And it's not because it's a fear that is quite sensible and natural given the way that we are brought up and the experiences that we have seeing other people in life. So these fears are not unreasonable that squeeze us. But the assertion of great spiritual teachers and masters is that there is, in fact, a way to innocence with knowledge. Innocence that can be in the world, the innocence of an adult who can be in the world, who has allowed him or herself experience of the world from a certain place, we might call that place presence, where the fear is not mediating the experience of engagement with the world. And when through greater and greater intensity of engagement, one eventually comes to a place, this is the assertion that we see made, I'm reinterpreting it in my own words here, we eventually can get to the place where the experience of being in the world is still or returns to a kind of innocence. But it's not an innocence of a child, because it understands that there are people out there who are acting out of fear. And they're therefore full of rules. And they will be saying no to life. And that's okay. It's not bad. They're not bad people. They're not doing the wrong thing. They're simply doing the best they can given the situation that they've, and the circumstances that they've experienced. But nevertheless, it is possible, this assertion holds, that one can be in this place of innocence without a self-censor all the time, without something saying no, no, no inside me.
Can I ask for a clarification?
Sure.
Possibly make a comment. In the Christian Bible, there's a statement by St. Paul who's mm-hmm. often maligned and misunderstood.
That would be the comment.
Paul said, to me, all things are permissible, mm-hmm. but all things are not profitable. And I think that you're right. Scripture again says from a biblical New Testament standpoint that mm-hmm. it is the fear of death that controls most people. Mm-hmm. But I think if you live with true presence, you don't operate from the position of permissibility. You operate from the position of profitability. Mm-hmm. And so clarify your understanding of there are no rules, if I've understood you correctly. Because I don't punch somebody in the face because there's a rule not to punch somebody in the face, mm-hmm. but because I'm genuinely present to that person. Mm-hmm. To be genuinely present means I don't punch you in the face.
Got it.
But that's a quote-unquote rule.
Right. Got it. And this is the heart of the discussion here. or at least the part of the distinction that we're making. I still want to get to how do we get there, but you're exactly right. What we get as we're growing up is mommy's voice saying, "Look both ways before you cross the street," or "Don't hit your playmate," in the case that you're proposing for us. And then that voice in your head, whether you recognize it as mommy's voice or not, you may, in fact. But whether you recognize it as mommy's voice or not doesn't matter. It's become, as you say, this rule. So the permissible is when those internalized rules no longer govern one's behavior. The profitability is a way of expressing the fact that when we allow ourselves to have experience of the adult social world from a place that acts as if we are not bringing rules to the game in that way, then we actually get data. Oh, if I hit Tommy, he's going to cry and I'm going to feel terrible. I don't want to feel terrible. You know? That's the profitability. Or Tommy might punch me back and let me, you know, give me that feedback. The universe will give me feedback. One of the things that the rules are designed to do is actually to prevent that feedback from happening. Because we're so afraid, and we're taught to be afraid, and we understand that we're supposed to be afraid, because that's the way other people act around us. We think that that's the way it's supposed to be. We assume that that's the way it's supposed to be. But that's why being around a great saint is so amazing.
Can I add something to that?
Please.
I think when he mentioned the ideas about, you know, if I hit Tommy in the face, you know, that there's a certain kind of response that I will experience from that. That as kind of a shorthand for a term that sometimes comes up of conscience. And the analogy I have for this, what we're talking about, or how I understand profitability in this context, is not a deliberative thing. It's not a because if I make it deliberative, there's all sorts of ways in which I'm angling when I decide what I'm going to do. And I have all sorts of metrics by which I can say what is profitable and what's not profitable. But there's something more fundamental than my cognitive processes, which is akin to my sense of balance. And so when I have a sense of balance, like when I learn to ride a bicycle, you know, there's a kind of a knowing at an instinctive level that allows me to self-correct in real time, or very fast, in order to move gracefully in you know, a way that I wasn't able to move before. And so in a similar sense, there's a kind of a balance that I relate to conscience. When we are in alignment with conscience, when we're in alignment with our conscience, that there is an effortlessness similar to the effortlessness of riding a bicycle. It's not really effortlessness, because there was a lot of work that came into the, you know, falling a lot before one came to that point of balance. But once you have that point of balance, it has a kind of a resiliency. And so similarly, I see that with what we're talking about here, that the kind of state that Rob is describing, that comes with making lots of mistakes in life, but being open to those mistakes and feeling the consequences of those mistakes, enables us to attain to a kind of a balance of conscience, such that we can begin to move more effortlessly or gracefully in the world, the human world, and the world of life in general, in a way that seems like, you know, all of a sudden, you know, the question of profitability doesn't arise, and yet we're operating on a kind of an instinctive love, knowing of that what I think St. Paul was referring to as profitability. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, because, again, I think that when you truly are present to another human being, even the idea of profitability becomes a non-issue, because do no harm becomes who you are. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Well, it does. It does from the perspective that we're talking about here. But it can only, I'll assert that it can only make sense from that perspective, which for most of us means a kind of cultivation. Very few of us are born as saints and bring into this human incarnation the innocence with knowledge that a saint has, to use that language. The reason I like the word innocence is it really does imply that unpremeditated quality of the existence of the experience of life of a child, and that's the distinction between, you know, the kind of experience that we are trained to have in general, which is based on fear and avoiding things that we think will trigger that in us. And so the cultivation of presence creates this innocence with knowledge, which is deeper and more interesting than the presence, if you will, of a child. I mean, the baby, when it is being held in its mother's arms, I'm looking into her eyes, is beautiful, whole, and complete. No doubt about it. And when I look into the eyes of a saint, the intensity and depth there may be, it's wider somehow. It's bigger. That it actually comes back to what Delia here was saying earlier about being able to be present to more than just yourself. Although that is where we always have to start. Really, presence starts here. It isn't what we do it isn't what we're doing in the world. It's how we engage with the world in many ways a very subtle level. Did you want to add something?
I have one more thought.
Mm-hmm.
In my life, I have found anyway that I was raised with an ideal of rules, Catholic rules, but there was a lot of love there. Mm-hmm. And I was allowed to be curious. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one way for an adult to have that innocence going throughout life, is if you're forever curious and open to new ideas. Mm-hmm. Doesn't that make you a little more innocent than someone who's like so suppressed?
Sure. There are degrees of this. Absolutely.
Wanting to have that one first experience. It doesn't have to be when you're 20s, 30s, 40s. You can always have that one, the first time I did this, the first time I experienced that.
Mm-hmm. There's absolutely degrees of it, for sure. And to return to what I was saying earlier, it's about expansiveness versus contraction in a very simple and simplistic way.
Yeah, I would say that the following rules in and of themselves are neutral. I mean, they're neutral. It's our relationship to the rules that makes the difference as to whether our relationship to the rules is contractive or neutral. You know, if we're following rules out of fear of punishment, there's a tendency to be contracted, and my experience is, both in myself and in just observing other people, is that you're less likely to engender that kind of curiosity you're talking about. Whereas, there's all sorts of rules that we ultimately have to follow to navigate life in the human realm and life in the material realm in general. There's rules of existence, physical rules, and there's rules of society, however strange they may be, that we have to follow in one form or another. But the following of them has to be an occasion for contraction. So the rules in and of themselves don't negate that openness or that curiosity. So when rules are delivered in a loving context to a child, they don't necessarily create a distortion, but when rules are given to a child in a fearful context or a threatening context, there's a tendency for contraction to happen. So the rules aren't the problem, it's our relationship to them.
So presence needs to be cultivated. That's the assertion that I was making earlier. And so then the question is, how does that happen? How do we achieve this innocence if we've lost it? How do we achieve it, regain the innocence? In a way, that's a restatement of the title of this talk, Renewal of Presence, Regaining Innocence. So what would be a way to do that?
So Michael, what would it be?
Hold on. Michael, do you have a question?
Piet Hein wrote these funny little poems that he called Grooks. And one of my favorites was, "The road to wisdom, well, it's plain and simple to express, to err and err and err again, but less and less and less."
You recited that well, actually.
Oh, thank you. I was having this sense that every time I open my mouth, I'm making a mistake. Everything I say is somehow a mistake. And I was just flashing back when I was in elementary school and getting a paper back from the teacher, these red X's, just these red X's, and the body response to those red X's, and I was just wondering, what if our mistakes were celebrated, as, or getting them wrong was celebrated as much as getting them right, somehow? I'm looking at what I'd call the sphere of possibilities, and each paradigm offers us a sphere of possible behaviors, possible ways to respond.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to break open that paradigm and expand your sphere of possibilities. And I think in order to do that, somehow you have to be able to celebrate your mistakes.
Yeah, I mean, what comes up for me about that is that there's like classes of rules and wrongness that we live in human bodies in a physical world, and for much of the history of humankind, mistakes were celebrated if you survived, because certain mistakes were terminal. Period.
Just walk out that out in that corner over there, and it can be a terminal mistake,
yeah,
really
right.
Easily.
Really, what's happening out there?
This is a dangerous corner.
Yeah.
Be careful walking across Main Street.
But so there is within the realm of the human experience real rules and real mistakes that have quantifiable costs, mm-hmm. and then there are social mistakes, and you know, there. And we were talking about conscience before. You know, when we hurt others, there is a natural response if we're willing to be open to it, which teaches us something. So I would agree insofar as that, you know, if we had a environment that cultivated us being open to the consequences of mistakes, so that we could receive what the mistake is teaching us or telling us, as opposed to an environment where there's such a stigma associated with a mistake that rather than looking at it, we immediately go to a defensive place or want to deny that we had the mistake. So in that sense, I would agree with you. But I think, you know, I want to resist the conclusion that if, you know, if we just are, you know, nice to everybody and, you know, don't have a differentiation between mistakes and successes or whatever that means, that it's possible that, you know, you lose something in that end of the spectrum as well.
So it's I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was wondering that, like, without fear, mm-hmm.
yes.
then courage wouldn't be asked of us. And courage, of course, is a great teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, there's this place of tension.
I agree. There's a place of tension where we don't actually have to resolve it, but you know, you're more pointing to this interesting
dialectic.
Yeah.
I think Esther DeWall calls it living in contradiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and any good teacher, I'll suggest any good parent knows just this. This difficulty. So how do you create a context of honesty about results that does not engender fear of admitting results or examining results? That arises from a context where there is a foundation of fundamental love and respect. Fundamental love and respect. And that's why I'm creating a project called Festival of Conscious Parenting, to help further that using spiritual practice techniques as a way to assist both, you know, everyone engaging with kids to do that. When a kid, for those first precious few years, early years, has unquestioned an experience of being loved and respected, then later, when the universe presents challenges that are inconsistent with that perspective, she or he can bounce back, can respond creatively. But for kids who haven't had that foundation, it can be really, really hard to find their way. Really, really hard to find their way. So, it happens at all levels. When I was teaching in the university level, I was trying to do that in seminars, where I was trying to, more importantly than communicating the subject matter in the seminar, my goal was to try to create a context where this group of, you know, 19, 20, 21-year-olds were able to learn how to agree and disagree with each other from a place of respect, where they could each actually hear what the other had to say without it just being a springboard for a reactive response. Now, you know, that you can only go as far as you can go with particular individuals, but this is an engagement which is the direction that the cultivation of presence takes. because it has to be not just oneself. It has to be how you create yourself through your interaction with other people. Yeah.
I wanted to speak to that cultivation of presence, which you said is necessary. I had the chance within the last year to revisit a favorite book from the 1970s called Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
And Robert Pearson, the author, uses the term presence. Mm-hmm. And the way I understand that he uses it is as a precursor to experience. Mm-hmm. It's like a tabula rasa, a blank slate before mm-hmm. anything happens. Mm-hmm. A state that could not be cultivated unless you're trying to cultivate emptiness, which of course the conventional traditions all do. But it's not an intellectual cultivation or something that would be an achievement to cultivate that. It would be a step before that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I'm linking it to the way that babies experience the world. Babies don't have to have an intellectual understanding at all.
But babies have a great experience of presence with you until a sparkling pinwheel comes by, and then you're gone, and the sparkling pinwheel is the what mm-hmm. they're focusing on, which is the difference you were saying between yeah. a great master and a baby. A great master of a sparkling pinwheel comes by, probably will stay with you. But the baby will go to whatever.
Maybe.
I would say that the similarity between the saint and the baby is that their attention is not on the pinwheel or on him. Their attention is on themselves and what they need. And that's why the Chinese would actually take a different take, and they say it's actually the contracting force that creates presence, and that babies are the most, they call it yang, the most youngest mm-hmm. beings there are, and as we grow up, we become more yin, and therefore have less presence, unless we can find a way to do that. And that it isn't necessarily, innocence isn't the best word, but if you can use the term selfishness in its best light, that would be a little more apropos, you know, would be like their sense of themselves. They are selfish. They do what they need to do, and the world, you know, basically tries to get their attention. Like you said, a baby walks in and everybody's like, oh, baby, look at, you know, trying to play cater to baby and child, you know, because they aren't catering to anyone else. So if you were looking for a path, you would probably try to, my advice would be to cultivate your inner compass rather than letting the world dictate a compass for you. And that would give you a more presence, give you more presence. You run your own show. And you will learn and adjust because you want your show to be successful. That's a different thing. But you won't change your show based on what the world expects from you or wants from you.
Okay.
You say you've looked into the face of a saint, right? So saints and babies wouldn't be on that same level, would they? I mean, a saint would not be selfish to that regard, would to that degree, don't you believe? Aren't they more agape, loving the world, that kind of thing?
Mike, I've met a number of such folks that I would consider, and they all happen to be very different folks, very different manifestations, very different ways of being in the world, and I don't have a disagreement with the idea of being more yourself, but where I would put the emphasis myself is we become more ourselves in our relationships with other people. That's where we become more ourselves. And so that's what a baby is doing at the level that a baby can do. And a saint can do it at a different level.
I mean, the way it occurs for me is that the what I find common between looking into the face of a saint and looking into the face of a baby is the absence of contraction. Now, a baby has an absence of contraction because in some sense it doesn't know any better. And a saint has an absence of contraction because at one point they knew better and then they let go of that knowing better. Mm-hmm. But somewhere in between, we are trained to know better and begin to contract from life. And
we know that people are dangerous.
Right.
We know that they might say something that might hurt our feelings or do something that we don't like.
Or we operate from a scarcity mentality, which is there's only so much energy, or I have to set boundaries, or this, that, and the other, and it becomes very difficult, actually. And this is one of the challenges of some of the comments earlier. It's when we start to look at being self-possessed and being our true self and all this sort of thing, it becomes very difficult. At least initially, to discern what of that is constructed and manufactured, a product of conditioning or a product of our lack of recognition of deeper habit patterns that are unexamined, and what of that is intrinsic in some sort of essential sense to who we are. And that's a big challenge, because people... There's lots of people who will tell you that they're self-possessed and have their own compass and everything like that, and yet their actions are not necessarily distinguished from either narcissism or sort of sense of being cut off from the world,
operating out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Yeah, but and the. The challenge is that for many people, they don't necessarily even recognize that the fear is operating. That's where it's trickier, because in my own practice, there in many circumstances, it's taken me years of training or years of discernment to recognize deep patterns of fear that we're operating. Deep patterns of wanting to hold back, which when they're not recognized, they kind of become this sort of nebulous or inchoate sense of, I don't feel like this, or I don't feel like that, or these are my tastes, or these are my likes and dislikes, without actually going deeply enough or being willing to challenge my comfort zone enough to recognize what's actually underneath all of that.
If you try to cultivate a loving presence, that casts out fear.
Mm-hmm. I think that one of the qualities of a loving presence is the kind of radiation. I use radiation in the terms of like the sun radiates, the kind of outflowing that I see kind of characteristic. That's like I said before. You kind of get that with babies, because babies don't know any better, mm-hmm. and they can't help but do that. Until the next shiny object comes along. But when you look at a baby for a while, there's this kind of outpouring, because they're just outpouring to the whole universe in all directions. Whereas cultivating a loving presence, I think, to use those words, is exactly that, the willingness to intentionally put our attention out on the world around us, to put our attention.
Well, there's another quality that I want to add mm-hmm. to that too. That is true, but it's also because of the way we've been trained, because of our experience. The trick is to put your attention out there in the way Stuart's saying, and not have the energy of radiation shut off by the habit of saying no, of judging the other person, even though you may go through an external drama of acting loving. If in your head you're believing that, oh, this person is a fool or hopeless or they'll never get it, then that's still not radiation.
I don't think that represents a loving presence either.
Exactly.
Right. The sun's a perfect example of, just like a baby, a very strong presence.
So there's a lovely book that we've discussed many times in our own practice on the shelf here by a guy named Jacob Needleman called Lost Christianities. And at the beginning of the book, he makes the point that Christianity has this ideal of embodying love. And yet, the trick is, you can say, embody love, until you're blue in the face, but that in itself won't get there. There has to be a step in between. And that was, you know, the sort of thing that the great Christian saints were able to do. They were actually find the step between the injunction to love and the actual radiation of love. In other words, there was something in between
the practice.
Practice.
Intention.
Exactly.
Intention.
Well, it's more than intention. I mean, it be in the sense that before I know how to ride a bike, you know, I may have the intention to get on that bike and ride, and then I fall over.
Oh, you practice.
You practice
your intention.
Yes, and so a practice. Intention is a critical enabling factor, but the point of Lost Christianity is that there's a practice, a path, a way of working, a way of engaging that will cultivate the conditions in which this loving presence can emerge.
I think one thing you can do with loving presence is allay fear in others.
Yeah, well, I would say that it has the effect of that, when we cultivate skillful means, as the Buddhists say, we can become more effective at intentionally doing that. But often, when we try too hard, people often pull back.
Religiosity, though, to me, is a little bit dangerous. I mean, I find it so...
Religiosity.
Yes. You know, an organization, because they can be very closed-minded. That's why I left Catholicism years ago. So, I mean, if you use it in the right sense, the true sense of Jesus was all-loving and healing and so on and so forth, but some Christians, they get very close-minded and they will not accept others. A certain church will not accept the presence of that person from that church or whatever else, you know? And that's what I find very dangerous about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, the point that we're making here is that
nothing
the...
to do with that, right?
Well, not precisely on that point, but the point is that practice will eventually, any sincere, well-crafted, consistently engaged in practice, will eventually efface those distinctions, because presence supersedes any such distinctions, those emotional distinctions, those intellectual distinctions, and then we get to the place where I was, you know, I've been talking about saints here. Well, saints have more than just presence, in my view, or have achieved, have tuned into, are able to embody more than just presence. They are increasingly embodying a non-dual, to use a very occurrent term, a non-dual, an undifferentiated kind of awareness where the distinctions between you and I that we think are so important are not worthy of the kind of attention that we've been giving them. That's getting back to where we started. Where are we putting our attention? Where are we putting our attention? So a saint is maybe putting his or her attention on God, in a way that effaces any of those sectarian distinctions, and even distinctions beyond sectarian.
So how do we cultivate practice?
How do we cultivate practice? Well, you're right that you were right to point to intention earlier, and usually it's good to find a preceptor, a teacher, a someone who's done it before, to help with the process that we were talking about earlier of not getting lost in the maze of the self, so that you can find the true self. And you know, it's a whole one of the images I like from my tradition is a hall of mirrors. You know, internally and externally, the universe can be like a hall of mirrors.
Yeah,
in time.
And to express that a little more, it's like one of the things that is necessary to cultivate practice is a context.
That's a time meant rather than practice.
But it is a context that supports that, or keeps in awareness the importance of doing that kind of work.
Yeah.
So, like for instance, you know, I work a daily job. When I go to work, that's not a context in which the cultivation of presence is an intention of the environment. The context is about the cultivation of profits for a corporation. And to be sure, you know, to the extent that cultivation of presence makes one do one's job better, then it's certainly not discounted or anything like that, but it's not an environment that is about that.
I think it would smooth your relationships with the other people you're in contact with.
No doubt. I mean, but the environment is not providing me with a reinforcement of that kind of work.
No, but you can bring something to it.
Sure, but you know, the point I'm making is that we need environments. We need communities that provide a reinforcement or a reminder or a pressure to continue to practice.
Teamwork, right?
Yeah, well, teamwork.
That's
or
the message these days.
Yeah, or even just what I would call a demand, you know, and not in a negative sense, but it's like a demand is. I have a stated intention to do a practice in a certain way. If I'm not on record as saying that and accountable to others for saying that, it's very easy to talk oneself out of it. You know, it's very, very easy to let that just sort of evaporate. And so the purpose of a community, you know, a spiritual school, a spiritual community, you know, a group of practitioners, whatever form it takes, even a spiritually inclined, you know, religious group for that matter, when there is a shared practice, which may take many forms, there's a shared intention and there's a demand, then it's possible to maintain a kind of ongoing cultivation of this work. When those elements aren't there, when the demand isn't there in particular, then it's more difficult for this kind of deepening or for the deepening to take place. And I might even go so far as to say that even with all of those elements, there's no guarantee. There is a certain something that's beyond us that is also a necessary ingredient. But as far as us creating the necessary conditions, those are the elements that we find is necessary.
I'm a priest. Mm-hmm. I've been a member of a monastic community for about 20 years, a little over 20 years, and that's exactly what the Wantwealth work says it should. That's what a monastic community provides. Mm-hmm.
You do
your daily offices twice a day, maybe more. You practice Lectio Divina. You say the Jesus prayer. and there are a multitude of other things. And it's almost, I think, in my experience in regards to what are the practices, it's almost like the spiritual direction given in recommending a book. Until I really know who you are and how you conduct your life and what you're all about, it's very hard for me to say A, B, and C will work for you.
Mm-hmm.
They may work for me, and there are certain general principles that apply to all, but to universally say this works for every, I don't think. Monasticism works for me.
Right, and I'd actually, just to add to that, you're adding an excellent point, which is it's within the context of community where there's enough intimacy with others, where whether it's through a spiritual leader or fellow practitioners, that advice and recommendations can come that provide mirrors to see parts of ourselves that are harder to see by ourselves, and that's again one of the beauties of a group working together.
And just before we then get to your question, Betty, I'll just add that this is, the general cultural context is not one where it's easy to find those kinds of supportive conditions. So they, I personally cherish every manifestation of them that I find and celebrate them, because they're not dime a dozen around us. Yeah.
I too follow a religious tradition, Christian tradition, and what I find there is the blessed company of all faithful people. And the other people that I meet are striving to achieve this kind of loving presence. And it reinforces it to me to be among them and to have the precepts repeated over and over, what Jesus enjoins us to do. And I find it very valuable. I couldn't do without it.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
Well, the Buddha said that Sangha is, that is, community is absolutely necessary. And to me, with my anthropological background, you need go no further than look at a troop of primates to see how important reinforcement from other primates is for us in these primate bodies. That's just part of the deal, being in these bodies, and that's reality.
But I will also add that what we do in our tradition is distinct from, say, for instance, a monastic tradition, in that by design we're sort of accepting that we're in the world, that we're not in a segregated community, and that there's an intention to try to use experiences in one's life as a, you may call it an engine for transformation, or we operate on the principle that with the intention and with the strength from a community that one is working with, that things that happen to us in the world, the events of our lives, become the food for this kind of work, and that it just seems to happen that way. That's one of the miracles that I find in spiritual practice, is that it's possible for every experience, everything that we experience, good or bad, wonderful, terrible, to be teaching us something about ourselves, about our ability to deepen and to be present in all moments. And that's sometimes, when you're living in a challenging world, and it's very difficult to just keep attention on any one thing. It can be difficult at times, but it also can be very powerful when, in the midst of all of that chaos, we begin to develop the capability or the capacity to hold more of it, to hold more of it at once.
I was, and I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me, I was reading a poem today, and there were a few lines that said something like, if we could all or if one can simply let go of the habit of blaming my own suffering on other people and circumstances outside me, then that's the opportunity to be able to realize and be that saint that we've been talking about. And that's something that takes remembering. You have to remember to do that, and that's practice. That's another way to describe practice, is remembering to do something. Sometimes it's ecstatic to do it, and other times it feels as if it could not be any more horrific and depressing and useless to do it, but you still do it, no matter which end of the scale you're experiencing or points in between. And that's how we can come to this greater clarity and this kind of generosity where that apparent scarcity of attention intensifies so deeply, expands so magnificently, that there is no need to act as if I don't have enough for you and you, you and you, 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 and you and you.
And yet we're almost out of time. But I should mention that this talk was intended to be a kickoff for the 2013 version of our study group by the same name, Renewal of Presence. We call this Meditation Action Group because the intention is to continue this dialogue on a weekly basis and also infuse the discussion with either practices or discussion of consequences of practices as people continue in this work.
Which is the way that we create the community that is so, we've just been discussing, is so necessary.
And everyone here is welcome. It's the format is it's open for people to come into, and we adapt depending on what the circumstances are. If someone comes in for the first time, or if people who've been around for a while, been there for a while, and it seems to work.
And beginner's mind is always good to return to.
Yeah.
It's true for me after 35 years, that's for sure.
Right. Actually, yeah, and I think, you know, certainly my experience and the experience of people who've been working with us for many years is, you know, when someone new comes in, it's great because then the discussion sort of refreshes, and it's always different. But
that's computer tech terminology. You brought in computer terminology.
I was thinking of something refreshing. But,
oh, good.
Not refreshing a screen. But I'd say that the purpose of the group is to help and provide a support in reminding ourselves of this work on a regular basis. You know, for those who aren't living with directly in a community or in a community household.
Right.
It's a way to just kind of keep returning to the well and returning to the work.
So that happens every Tuesday nights here at 7:30 p.m. And we thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.